Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Hello, podcast person, and you're a very special person if you're downloading this. Thanks for choosing this podcast. I'm John Hockenberry, host of The Takeaway, a program that's produced by WNYC and Public Radio International. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and for the people of Boston, this will be a week that tests an entire community.
Our style has always been to reassure everyone. I don't want that Copley Square, the Boston area, to look like an armed camp. So we're going to try to low-key all our assets so people don't feel that like it's a police state.
We are broadcasting today, Tuesday and Wednesday, from the studios of our partner, WGBH Boston Public Radio. Thanks so much for listening. And that's Boston Police Commissioner William Evans, who will be joining us later in the hour to talk about his personal response to the bombing a year ago and the preparations this city is making a year later. We'll hear from runners and a veteran marathon coach, people with vivid memories of a year ago they're still dealing with. And we'll see how the formidable scientific minds in this university community have put their efforts to understanding what it takes to bounce back after a tragedy. But we begin with the violent developments in multiple cities in eastern Ukraine, teetering on the brink of what looks like civil war between Ukrainian forces and pro-Russian militants. The U.S. has accused Russia of fomenting the pro-Russian militants, while Russian officials accused the U.S. of orchestrating the unrest among Ukrainians that precipitated this crisis. Here is the level of tension on display yesterday at the United Nations Security Council.
We are not going to let the Crimea scenario repeat in the eastern Ukraine. Instead, we have prepared the counterinsurgency plan to strike the armed terrorists.
That's Ukraine's ambassador to the UN, Yuri Sergeyev, and here's the U.S. ambassador, Samantha Power.
You have heard these last weeks Russia disclaim any intention of occupying or invading. You have heard it publicly, and we have heard it privately. Unfortunately, the fact is that the armed seizure of buildings in six eastern Ukrainian towns yesterday and several more today mirrors the tactics Russian forces used in the early stages of the Crimea invasion.
And, of course, a very different view from Vitaly Churkin, the Russian ambassador to the UN, speaking to reporters yesterday.
Those troops have been there for quite a while. They've been exercising there. They're on our territory. We have allowed all sorts of inspections which were there, including Ukrainian inspections, to make sure that this is nothing out of the nothing extraordinary about the presence of those troops.
Question, is this the brink of war, or are we seeing the limits of NATO's influence in Europe and its expansion, which has gone on continuously since the fall of the Soviet Union in the early 90s? Joining us is John Mearsheimer, professor of political science at the University of Chicago and the author of The Tragedy of Great Power Politics. Professor, welcome.
Thank you.
So has NATO stepped too far here, and that what we're seeing is Russia's reaction and that the West didn't really anticipate this?
Yes, I think that's exactly what's happened. Most Americans don't understand it, but the taproot of this crisis is NATO expansion. Since the mid-1990s, the United States and its European allies have been pushing NATO further and further eastward. And in 2008, NATO announced that Ukraine and Georgia would eventually become part of NATO. This infuriated the Russians, and the Russians made it clear that this was unacceptable. Then this past February, you had a coup that brought to power in Kiev a government that's decidedly anti-Russian and very pro-Western and would actually like to integrate Ukraine into the West. This is unacceptable to the Russians. The Russians acted, and the Russians are now in the process of making it clear that they will wreck Ukraine rather than allow it to integrate into the West.
What would have been the alternative? I mean, what you're describing suggests that we should simply allow Putin to operate in his so-called sphere of influence here, rather than attempting to maintain the territorial integrity of Ukraine.
No, that's not true at all. What we should have done was not pushed NATO eastward to include Ukraine, and we should have allowed Ukraine to remain as a neutral buffer state between Russia and NATO, which it was before 2008. In that case, the Russians would have left Ukraine alone. The main reason that the Russians are so deeply involved in Ukraine now is because NATO, and especially the United States, is trying to integrate Ukraine into the West, which is unacceptable to Moscow because it's right on Russia's doorstep. So there is no reason for this crisis. That we should have just kept Ukraine as a neutral buffer state, and that should be our goal now, to go back to the status quo ante.
Doesn't that argument apply to Poland, which is on the doorstep, or even the Baltic states, Estonia, Lithuania?
It does not apply to Poland because Poland is separated from Russia by Ukraine. We got away with incorporating Poland and the Baltic states into NATO because in the 1990s and the early 2000s, Russia was very weak and was not in a position to contest us. But Russia in recent years has gotten much more powerful under Putin. And because Ukraine is right on its doorstep and Poland is not on its doorstep, Ukraine is a completely different issue.
If, as you say, this was coming because of the expansion of NATO, would that have called for a kind of new Yalta conference where there would have been a discussion between the players in the region, the U.S., the traditional NATO powers and Russia about what does constitute the buffer state in Europe, the limits of NATO, that sort of thing, rather than allowing this to be crisis determined?
Well, you really didn't need a Yalta. The Russians told us loudly and clearly on numerous occasions since the mid-1990s that NATO expansion up to their borders was unacceptable. We refused to believe what the Russians said. We thought that we could continue to expand NATO and get away with it. And we were wrong. And by the way, this is the principal reason that we were shocked by the recent crisis. We did not anticipate it. The fact is that the people who run American foreign policy inside the Beltway do not understand basic power politics. And there's no way that a country like the United States can get away with pushing its alliance, NATO, up to Russia's doorsteps.
A voice on the Ukraine crisis, John Mearsheimer, is professor of political science at the University of Chicago and author of The Tragedy of Great Power Politics. Thanks so much, John.
My pleasure.
Just to remind you, we're broadcasting today from WGBH in Boston, where the question for so many this week in this community is to run or not to run.
I knew that if I didn't run because of being afraid, then they would have won. I mean, that's the whole idea of terrorism, right? So I knew that I wanted to get out there and run and, you know, show, I don't know who, but show somebody that, that I wasn't afraid and that nobody should be afraid and that we should, you know, keep doing the race.
That is runner Corinne Glennie. Her decision to run this year comes despite crossing the finish line last year just a few minutes before the first bomb exploded, interviewed by the news team at our partner WGBH. She's a graduate student at Tufts University and a member of this year's Tufts Marathon team. What is that decision like, to run or not to run? How to approach an event that has changed so many lives? Mackenzie Loy is one of the Tufts runners. There are about 150 of them. Also with us is longtime marathon coach Don Meggerly. Coach Mackenzie, welcome.
Hello, John.
Hello, John.
So you've decided to run this year, and you were there last year. How does last year's experience come into play as you think about what you're going to do this year?
My dad and I both decided to run last year. Neither of us finished, and so when we were given the opportunity to run again this year, I think we thought about it, but there was no thinking the answer was going to be yes.
And normally when someone says, I didn't finish, it was because something physically happened and you ran out of steam or something like that. That's not the case for so many runners this year. You didn't finish because of the bombing.
No, and when people ask, oh, how many marathons have you run? And I say, well, I mean, one, and then there's Boston last year, and everybody says, you count that. You ran that one. That counts as a finish.
To not finish a race, Coach, for whatever reason, is an emotional experience for a marathoner. Talk about that.
You're right, John. And I've met with several runners over the years that have not finished the race due to injury-related or not dieting properly or drinking or hydrating or pacing. And if they finish 1 mile less of the race, the next day they are distraught emotionally. And when we met the next day after the marathon last year, that was on my mind a lot. And I tried to explain to them that although they didn't officially finish, in my mind, they were finishers.
So What is it like this year? How does the events of a year ago play into the training, to the lead-up? You heard Corinne Glennie there talking about how I'm going to show somebody something.
Ironically, I've never talked to the group about it because there's so many new runners this year, the team of 100. I don't want to take away from them the pleasure, the anticipation, the excitement, the thrill of getting ready for the marathon. And I didn't want to put in their mind that everything is suspect about the negatives, the bad side of it, the potential terrorist threat.
Mackenzie, fear, distraction, do you put it out of your mind? Do you embrace it? Do you want to show somebody something like Corinne?
I think a race, it's an emotional roller coaster anyways, and you're shooting for something so hard for, you know, months of training, and then the actual race day, it's something like 3-4 hours you're going for the same goal. So to not finish, I think all of us feel that we either just for closure or to prove something, but also just for ourselves to know that we can finish that and that we were going to, and that nothing will stop us. So,
on some level, though, the Boston that you saw a year ago will look a little bit different. There'll be subtle signs of the security presence, of the extent to which you're kept away from the audience, the people standing by the side of the road. What's that going to be like for you, Mackenzie?
I think one of the best things about Boston is the support that occurs along the route. So I just hope that it doesn't take away from that. But at the same time, you know, any safety precautions, I'm okay with that at the same time.
Sure. You know, Mackenzie talks about the most powerful thing about the Boston Marathon, New York Marathon, these marathons that have grown as spectator sports, that encouragement that you get.
Just watching for things that could happen, it was extraordinary.
And this year, what's that crowd going to look like to you? Are you going to be able to get close to it? Are you going to be at the finish
line? The last
line?
9 years, my big thing with the Tufts runners has always been at the finish line. To greet them, as I like to say, the Tufts runners are leaving Hopkinton and they're running to Don. And to not be there, for me, it's a difficult thing to deal with. And I found out 3 weeks ago because of the regulations and restrictions. So I've dealt with it. I've gotten over it. But I want to explain to the runners before our team dinner that I won't be at the finish line. But at the same time, they're still running to the finish. They're running to Don. They're running to their families. And they're running to their friends.
It's an emotional situation for you. This will be like no other of the marathons you've coached.
If you could see some of the pictures of the kids finishing, they look like they're grimacing. They're in pain. But they're in pure satisfaction, pure joy, pure emotion. It is something only when you finish that marathon. The next 10 seconds of your life, everything changes. It's extraordinary.
Distance runners talk about how there's a pain associated with running, and that at a certain point in a race, you project your mind forward to, this is over. Will you be glad for a lot of other reasons, too, to be beyond this, Mackenzie?
I haven't even thought to the day past. I'm just kind of going for the finish, and I imagine there will be a sense of relief, but I know I can't think past it yet.
I think there'll be also not only a sense of closure, but a sense of healing. We had our last long run where we had a couple hundred have to cross the Boylston Street finish line for the first time in over a year, for myself included. And that was an emotional time. And my mind went right back to the day of the marathon with the bombing, what we witnessed that day.
Coach Don Meggerly is the marathon coach of the Tufts University team. Mackenzie Loy is one of the 150 runners who will be running the Boston Marathon this year. Mackenzie and Don, thanks so much.
Thank you so much, John.
Thank you, John.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International, in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
This is an emotional week for the people of Boston. We are broadcasting from WGBH in Boston this week to mark the one-year anniversary of the Boston Marathon bombing. Boston Police Commissioner William Evans is with us now. And a question for everybody today in this community: how does your experience of the tragedy a year ago affect your approach to the events of this week? Commissioner Evans was one of the first responders on the scene after bombs went off on April 15th. Commissioner Evans, welcome.
Welcome, John.
What was that like? You were barely done running the race yourself when you were helping the victims.
Yeah, you know, I'm a big marathoner. I've done Boston Marathon 18 times, so, you know, coming up Hereford Street onto Boylston, it was a beautiful day. Crowd was great. You know, I finished. My wife and my son, Will, were there and couldn't ask for more picture-perfect day. And, you know, I went home and all of a sudden I was in the hot tub and at an athletic club and one of my officers ran in and said two bombs went off. And, I, you know, it's something I'll never forget. I'm like, that can't happen here in the city. And the whole way there, you know, I shot in my car, went home, got dressed, got right back into work. And the whole way there, I remember saying, you know, I hope it's just a transformer or something, because we've had several transformers blow up in that Copley Square area. But when I went on Boylston Street and seeing the destruction and seeing the bodies, it's something that was surreal to me, because an hour earlier I had run down that street. And so then obviously I had to put my work hat on, and, you know, I think I stayed there and worked for a good 41 straight hours before I went back home, you know.
You ran a marathon, you went home, relaxed for a minute, and then became a sprinter for the next 41 hours.
Yeah, and, you know, people say, you know, how did you do it? I think it was pure adrenaline. Initially, you know, coming out of the hot tub, you know, that can be tough, but, you know, the adrenaline just kept me moving.
What did we learn about the Boston PD? What did we learn about the feds, the FBI? What did we learn about all the cameras around us that week? And then what did the people of Boston learn about each other, do you think?
Well, I think we all learned that us being familiar with the FBI and the state all paid dividends that day. We had done a lot of training over the last couple of years in scenarios, what if something like this happened? And all our outside agencies participated in that, as well as the hospitals did. So when the bombs went off, we knew each other's role, and everyone jumped into action. And I think you've seen the great job that the men and women of the Boston Police Department did, jumping into that crowd, putting tourniquets on people who needed it, great response by our officers. And it's tragic. We lost three beautiful children that day on the street, and it's a memory that I'll always have when I return to that scene.
Did it surprise you that when the state of emergency was declared, the lockdown of the city was declared, that everybody complied pretty much?
You know, it really did. I was out in Watertown. I had been out there since 1 o'clock in the morning, John, and I knew at 5:30 in the morning that they had made the call to shut down the T. But honestly, I was out there running around all day with the tactical teams and our officers out there, that I wasn't really aware what was going on behind the scenes. I didn't know how the city reacted. All I was concerned with on that day was catching that second suspect. But as far as Watertown goes, it was amazing how many people complied with our wishes. We didn't see one person out walking all day. The people of Watertown were super. You know, they were opening up their homes, letting us use their bathrooms, asking if we want anything to eat. And so we were busy all day, that I had really no idea the extent of the lockdown, to tell you the truth, because we were focused on finding that second suspect all day.
You described the level of cooperation once the bombing happened, but many reports have looked at the extent to which law enforcement agencies share information. And in many ways, that might have been a problem here. We saw that in 9/11 down in New York. We've seen that again and again with sharing of information, even within the federal government.
Right.
What do you make of the lack of sharing of information as a contributing factor here?
Well, you know, we've gotten very good at sharing information. You know, we have our Boston Regional Intelligence Unit every day that brings in a lot of our partners. We have the Joint Terrorism Task Force. In this particular case, I know there's a lot of controversy on could the FBI have shared that information better. You know, I know Commissioner Davis was dealing with that issue, but we had no intelligence going into that day that there was any threat to that race. And I think if we did, obviously, it would have been a whole different game plan. But, you know, since that time, obviously, the information sharing has gotten a lot better. You know, we speak daily with the FBI on our intelligence calls. I mean, years past, police agencies would share nothing. And so this particular case, and I don't want to be Monday morning quarterbacking, could the FBI have done a better job? I don't really know. But I know since that time, it's improved greatly.
Take me to race day a week from now. What will you be doing? And if you see a mom waiting for a son or daughter to run past, and you notice that they're a little bit scared, they're a little bit apprehensive, what do you say to them to reassure them about the preparations this time around?
Well, again, the message I've been sending out, and I have been all along, is we expect this to be a super day. The day it's always been, the Boston Marathon, the most premier marathon in the world. We want to return it to what it's always been. And we're going to have plenty of undercover officers out there.
we're going to have uniform presence, plenty of cameras. So we're very confident in the plan we have. So if I see someone out there, our style has always been to reassure everyone. I don't want that Copley Square, the Boston area, to look like an armed camp. So we're going to try to low-key all our assets so people don't feel that like it's a police state. I don't want them to look up and see policemen on top of buildings with rifles. I don't want those long guns out. That's the presence we're going to have. We're going to be all over the place. We're going to be on everything, but not to the point that people should fear us. You know, things are tense. I mean, my wife and my child were there last year, and I think some people are going to be hesitant to come into the area. But all I can do is reassure them that we have a great plan. We have eyes and ears on our whole route in Boston, and they should have nothing to be afraid about.
You going to run?
No. You know, I love running. I've done 46 marathons. I had signed up back 6 months ago with the same hope to run it, to prove to everyone that we won't be intimidated. But, you know, November 1st, Mayor Menino put me as acting commissioner, and then Mayor Walsh, who's a great mayor, you know, he put me here. And my role, unfortunately, now is to make sure the day goes well. On game day, and I got the utmost confidence in our men and women.
A lot of responsibility, different kind of marathon this year for Boston Police Commissioner William Evans. Good luck and thanks so much.
Well, thank you.
Later in the hour, when can a community finally see the marks left on everyone by tragic events? There's a spiritual quality of character regarding how people bounce back and plenty of science. We'll talk about both later this hour. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry at the studios of WGBH in Boston. It's a somber start for many for the Jewish holiday of Passover after a gunman opened fire outside a Jewish community center and retirement community in Overland Park, Kansas, a suburb of Kansas City, killing 3 people. The gunman was identified yesterday as Frazier Glenn Cross. He's being charged with first-degree murder. Cross is a former Ku Klux Klan Grand Dragon with a history of anti-Semitism and a significant rap sheet. Joining us now is Mark Potok, senior fellow at the Southern Poverty Law Center. Mark, welcome.
Well, thank you for having me. Pleasure to be here.
Frazier Glenn Cross is someone well-known to your organization.
Yes. His name really is Frazier Glenn Miller. Cross is an alias he's been using. We have tangled with this man over the last 30 years repeatedly. In particular, back in the mid-1980s, he actually plotted to assassinate the founder of SPLC, Morris Dees. He at the time was running a kind of paramilitary Klan outfit called the White Patriot Party. They were really Klansmen, but trained with weapons. In fact, it turned out they were getting both training and stolen military weapons from active military personnel at the time.
How does someone with weapons violations with this kind of a record even get a hold of a gun, let alone stalk a Jewish community center?
Well, of course, I don't know the details, but I think the reality in this country is it's very easy. You go to a gun show, for instance, and buy one, and there you are going through the loophole. You don't have to do any kind of background check. So, I mean, I think as a practical matter, that has never proved to be a problem.
How much of a shock is this to the community of Kansas City, or has there always been a level of tension, an uneasy coexistence?
Well, I haven't spoken to anyone there, but I have no doubt that it was a real shock. In the same breath, though, I should say that in Jewish institutions around the country, in Western Europe, and in particular around Kansas, where there has been quite an active white supremacist movement over the decades, it couldn't have come as a total surprise. The reality is that most synagogues and Jewish institutions in the country have fairly elaborate security. And the sad thing is, it's really necessary.
What is Frazier Glenn Miller's particular ideology regarding anti-Semitism and the Jewish community around the world?
Well, he's essentially a neo-Nazi. He sees Jews as the real evil out there, much worse than black people, brown people, gay people, and so on. He's also what I would say defines him, though, more than most people in this movement is this is a violent man with violent ideas. He served 2 tours in Vietnam. He was 13 years in the Green Berets. So this is a scary fellow, a guy who's been around weapons for much of his life, and who clearly enjoys using them. He's been
and when confronted, he responds. You sued him in the 1980s, and that precipitated his confrontation of your organization.
That's right. We sued him. He signed a consent decree, an agreement whereby he would shut down the group he was then operating, pled guilty to a weapons charge. But then he went on the lam, and it took some 6-7 months before he was in fact caught again by the FBI and ultimately sentenced to prison. And he probably would still be in prison today were it not for the fact that at the time he cut a deal with the federal government, incredibly enough, to inform, to testify against other white supremacists in the very famous 1986 sedition trial in Fort Smith. But the government completely lost that case. No one was convicted. And Miller has somehow come back from being seen as a rat.
Extraordinary. Mark Potok, senior fellow at the Southern Poverty Law Center, commenting on the shooting at the Jewish Community Center in the Kansas City area over the weekend. Thanks so much, Mark. This week, we look back at a natural disaster with our friends at the Retro Report, the October 1989 Loma Prieta earthquake.
We were just driving into the parking lot at Candlestick Park when we felt the earthquake. Police officers came to me and said, "Mr. Mayor, we've got to take you to the command post downtown because the Bay Bridge has fallen in."
An amazing story. That's Art Agnos, the former San Francisco mayor, just one of the many spectators in Candlestick Park that day, where the San Francisco Giants and the Oakland A's were facing off for the World Series. I watched those pictures in amazement back in 1989. I happened to have been in the U.S. on a holiday from a 2-year-long assignment in the violent Middle East, and it was shocking to witness this disaster close to home.
Oakland A's take.
Unbelievable. The shuddering jolts of the quake broadcast there at 6.9 on the Richter scale. Eric German is a Retro Report producer, joins me now. Eric, welcome.
Thanks.
You know, part of the importance of this story is that the rebuilding and the lessons being learned from that event are still going on. The bill's still being paid.
That's absolutely true. The quake was a real wake-up call in the sense that it happened in a more public way than maybe any other earthquake before it. It happened on live television. It was, you might say, America's first television earthquake. It was also at a time when there was a lot more surveillance video and small video cameras to kind of capture the shaking. And so all of it was put on the television news in this very big way, and it broke in a very big way across the country.
Let's talk about infrastructure for a moment. The Bay Bridge, of course, damaged so much of the infrastructure of the Bay Area was damaged. Here's Steve Heminger, executive director of the Metropolitan Transportation Commission, who you spoke with.
It's unprecedented. The cost of the bridge behind my shoulder is a little over $6 billion. The cost of retrofitting or replacing all the toll bridges in our region for earthquake safety was about $9 billion. If you want to throw in those 2,000 highway bridges, you're probably throwing in another couple billion on top of that.
What kinds of retrofitting and how confident are people that this is going to make them relatively earthquake-proof?
Well, there's no such thing as earthquake-proof. Lawmakers and policymakers there made a huge commitment to making the state as safe as they could. And the biggest area where they've seen progress is in public infrastructure.
And geologically speaking, the Loma Prieta quake really made the point that regardless of the mileage on Interstate 5 there north to south in California, the geological fault line involves the state of Oregon, Washington, the entire region. You talked with Chris Goldfinger, who is a geologist at Oregon State University.
The last one occurred more than 300 years ago, so we're already skating on thin ice. And when we dug into it a little further, we found out the actual repeat time it's more like 240 years for any of these earthquakes. So we're not only on, we're out past the edge of the thin ice.
Did you find that the region is on a state of vigilance here?
Well, there's a real difference between the way California has viewed earthquake preparedness and the way other states have viewed it. In the Pacific Northwest, there is a huge, you know, risk of an offshore quake, but there hasn't been a really big shaker there since basically 1700.
And the interesting thing here is that in terms of social preparedness and vulnerability for an earthquake, complacency is one of the huge issues as you look city to city, community to community, according to Dennis Miletti, who's a sociology professor at the University of Colorado.
The number one motivator to get the public in general to prepare for high consequence, low probability events is to go through one. And the public in Oregon is no different than the public anywhere. They don't perceive there's a tsunami risk or that there's an earthquake risk. Why? They haven't personally experienced it. Preparedness in California is as good as it gets, which doesn't mean it's adequate.
That's a high bar for preparedness there.
Well, it is, and the stakes are very high as well. And so if you want to look at California, you know, they've made gigantic strides in preparing their public assets. But there's all kinds of work that needs to be done in the area of private homes, private buildings, and, you know, plenty more. The list can go on and on. But at least earthquake preparedness has become kind of a civic religion.
Eric German is a Retro Report producer thinking back to the 1989 Loma Prieta, California earthquake. Thanks so much, Eric.
Thanks for having us.
While the profile has been lower in the United States, it is not an exaggeration to say that outside of the crisis in Ukraine, the murder trial of Oscar Pistorius has captured the attention of the world. Pistorius has been outwardly emotional on the witness stand since last week, talking about his devastation over, by his account, accidentally shooting girlfriend Reva Steenkamp. If anything, his encounters with the prosecution have been even more emotional, facing a skeptical chief prosecutor, Jerry Nell.
The cross-examination we'll focus on today is that your version is so improbable that it cannot be reasonably possibly true.
Here's a bit of the cross-examination from today, Jerry Nell firing his questions and Pistorius addressing his answers to the woman judge, Thokozile Masipa.
The state's case, Mr. Pistorius, that she wanted to leave and that you weren't sleeping. You were both awake.
That's not correct, my lady. It's untrue.
And that there was an argument.
That's not true, my lady.
My lady, defendant Pistorius says, a black woman judge and two so-called assessors will decide this case, as there are no jury trials in South Africa. It is also not an exaggeration to say that the South African justice system is on trial here, in a sense, visible to the entire world, and that's been an emotional moment for everyone in South Africa. BBC South Africa correspondent Milton Nkose talked about that after an exhausting week of testimony outside the courtroom in Pretoria.
South Africans of all races across the country are transfixed, John, on this case, because this is a rare case in South African court history. It's being broadcast live on radio and television. South Africa is not used to having cameras and microphones in court cases of this nature. And this was a separate case on its own to get the permission to allow cameras in this court case. So everyone is following this in their cars, on the radios, at home, on television. There is a 24-hour TV channel dedicated just to this trial. I might just add that there is an election coming up on the 7th of May. Political parties are campaigning. They are out in full swing trying to get votes. And the country has only one topic in its mind. It's the Oscar Pistorius trial.
This public awareness of this trial so starkly contrasts with the secret proceedings that characterized the apartheid era, the whole idea of the justice system being a place where people would be thrown and never heard from again. This is so different, and yet it's about a case of an athlete, a disabled athlete, and the woman he claims to have loved.
And many South Africans, when they look at this trial, especially the courtroom pictures, for them, it validates the nature of the democracy that South Africa has grown up to become in the last 20 years since the end of apartheid in 1994. People are proud that here is a court in the heart of Pretoria, which was the headquarters of the apartheid regime, and you have a white prosecutor, a white defense counsel, all talking to a black woman who is the judge. And remember, black people until 20 years ago were not even allowed to vote in the country of their birth. It is almost a miracle to sit and watch here in a historical sense, because not so long ago, this could have been impossible.
Do people find Pistorius compelling? Are they sympathetic to him? Certainly there's been some testimony that just goes way beyond the notion of privacy and candor that you would expect almost anywhere in the world.
People are split on Pistorius, and given that we don't have the jury system, I can't say the jury is still out on public opinion there, but you could argue that that the country is still divided on the sympathy for Mr. Pistorius. When I listen to the local radio talk shows and I look at the letters to the editor and I look at social media comments, there are many people who dismiss his emotions in court, his tears in court, his cracking up as just theatrics. In fact, people are making jokes that he should win an Oscar for his performance, playing around his name and, of course, the award name of the Academy. And also, there are other people who feel for him, who feel that maybe, just maybe, he's telling the truth. It's just that he was reckless, but perhaps he did not intend or plan in a premeditated way to murder River Steenkamp. So the idea about his emotion and sympathy, I think, cuts right across the country. There is a woman who turned up when Oscar Pistorius left court. She was just waiting out in the crowd, and she gave him this amazingly beautiful bunch of flowers and a very firm long hug, in a way of saying there are people who believe in you and who think that you are innocent until proven guilty. And remember, John, Oscar is a hero here in South Africa. He won medals at the Olympics for this nation. He made the country proud. And of course, he made people believe in themselves. How can a double amputee outrun able-bodied athletes? And he made every amputee believe that nothing is impossible.
Finally, Milton, what does this trial say about the gun culture in South Africa and the availability of firearms, which for Oscar Pistorius was really part of the issue that came up on the witness stand?
That's a very good question, John. There are many issues that this trial bring up. We spoke about the legacy of apartheid just a short while ago, but also the trial brings up the gun culture in South Africa, that people carry guns, people are obsessed about gun ownership. And also it brings out the issue of crime. Remember, there is another trial which is almost underway, and the groom is about to go on trial for murdering his wife while they were in Cape Town on honeymoon in 2010. And so South Africans are watching and following in the news these huge, highly publicized trials about the nature of how their country is still a violent one or characterized by violence. And I think that there will be many people, especially from those who are fighting for gender equality rights, who think that there are still very high levels of violence against women. They will think that an acquittal of Pistorius would probably be a setback in their fight to try and highlight the plight of violence against women.
Milton Denkosi is the BBC's South Africa correspondent. We spoke to him outside the courtroom, the Oscar Pistorius courtroom in Pretoria, South Africa. Milton, thanks so much.
Thanks, John. Great to talk to you.
How do humans adapt? How do difficult events and tragedies become part of
how we deal with what is in front of us. What determines whether an event demoralizes and weakens a community, or whether it strengthens, brings people together?
One of the most interesting things that you find when you begin to look at the sort of big patterns of resilient communities is that very frequently, the communities that are most resilient are the ones that paradoxically have a history of prior disruption. And the reason for that is because the memory of past failure and past disruption is in a critically important part of readiness and adaptability.
That's futurist and author Andrew Zolli, who wrote a book on resilience. To see that process in the eyes of people coping with tragedy, that was the job of Rich Sorino for years when he was deputy administrator at FEMA, and he was on the job during last year's attack at the Boston Marathon. He joins us now along with Kara Miller, host of PRI and WGBH's Innovation Hub. Kara, Rich, welcome.
Thanks.
Thank you.
So you've seen the character, the sort of social dimensions of how people respond to a tragedy. What's that like, Rich? And describe your experience last year.
Well, last year I happened to be here in Boston for the marathon. And one thing that was very impressive to look at is to see how people responded, both the first responders and the general public at large. And Boston Strong has come the anthem here, and that was no accident. It was no accident that people were prepared. It was no accident that not anybody that left the scene alive is alive today. And it was no accident that they all didn't go to the same hospital. It was no accident that they had the right equipment. It was no accident that while everybody was able to respond to the incident, they knew what they were going to be able to do from years of training.
How does that training, that knowledge, that sense of shared, we know what to do now, this is no drill, how does that play into what happens in the aftermath, in the idea of how communities bounce back?
Well, one way to cultivate resilience is to make sure that the people, and, you know, Rich sort of talks about this, but the people who are responding are a diverse group of people. So, you know, you had people in the medical community, you had fire, you had police. And in part, you want them to be diverse, both across departments, but also racially and in terms of gender, because you have to think about the people who are being affected by the tragedy and how are those people going to react. And if you have everybody thinking the same way, you're only going to be able to project for a certain group of people and how they're going to respond.
So you want a shared experience, but you also have to have maximum buy-in of all facets of the community so that people can really be flexible as to the different needs of different communities.
You know, that's really right. And people really want to help. I mean, if you think about humans biologically, we are really built to bounce back. I mean, we evolved in a situation where there were predators, right? And we were trying to deal with that kind of situation and then the next day come back and be fine. So most people in most situations are really, really resilient. And so people are looking for a way to sort of have that resilience kick in. And part of that is saying to people, hey, here's what you could do to help, and so that they feel active.
You know, part of that resilience right here, Kara, is the huge scientific expertise at MIT and Harvard. I mean, they have been a part of the bounce back by re-exploring the scientific basis of some of the various issues that you've just described.
No, that's right. And one thing that very major studies have found is that people in communities that bounce back, before the tragedy ever happens, they have a connection going in. So it might be that they have a very strong connection with a mentor at school. It might be that they have a very strong connection with a family member. It might be that they have a very strong identification with their neighborhood. But they go back to that relationship when something traumatic happens. And people who don't have those kinds of pre-existing relationships going into a tragedy have a very, very tough time bouncing back.
As an emergency management planner, as someone who worked at EMS here in Boston and with FEMA, how do you build that into policy? How do you determine who's got the toughness and who really needs an extra helping hand at something like this?
I think one thing that's important is we have stressed for years that the saying goes, you don't want to be exchanging business cards at the scene of a disaster. And that really goes back to developing the relationships long beforehand. But it goes past just meeting each other. It's also developing trust over time. The response here in Boston, whether it was Ed Davis or, you know, now Commissioner Billy Evans or Jimmy Hooley, who's currently the chief of EMS, Danny Linsky, superintendent in chief, all those people, we knew each other for 20 and 30 years. We have been through some tough times together, both at the public sector, but also some people from the private sector. And it's really bringing, as Tara mentioned, it's really bringing in all the different people together ahead of time so they can develop those relationships of what we call the whole community.
So no business cards at the scene of a tragedy. That's great. So when the bombs went off,
there's like a checklist in your mind that immediately pops up? Is that what happened to you?
I think that's exactly what happens is you start to, you know, first, you know, takes a second or two to register. And, you know, you're hoping that it was just, you know, a propane tank or a transformer fire. But soon as the second one went off, everybody sort of knew that this was real. This was exactly what it was. And a lot of people went back to September 11th, though, this is real. Now kick it in. And now your training really kicked in. And there was one point when we were in the West End, you know, this was probably an hour or so after the bombs had gone off and the command post was being formed in the West End. And superintendent in chief at the time, Dan Linsky, said, you know, I was with somebody who they didn't recognize. And who's that? We just pointed over and said it was somebody with me. But other than that, all about 35 or 40 people, the mayor, the governor, the heads of all the department, we all knew each other. And we all knew each other for years.
The trauma was the bombing, but it was also the manhunt that went on for a week.
Yeah.
How is that going to be reflected in the report that you're doing coming up later this week on all of this sense of bouncing back here in Boston?
Well, I mean, it was an incredible situation. I mean, I just remember it so well. I mean, you had a very new baby, and you were basically locked into your house. Now, I think in some ways, you know, to go back to what I said about people being helpful— people in communities enforced that order that the governor gave to stay in your home. So, you know, this was not something that the military, if you went out onto the street, like nobody, this was not a military state. Nobody was going to turn you back and put you back in your house. So it was really a community. It was individual people who said, you know what, I can be helpful. Like, this is the most helpful thing I can do is stay home. And so I think we were all feeling like we were helping emergency management by doing that. And I have to say, when you see Boston bounce back, I think in part it is because it is a very strong neighborhood sort of place. People have those connections with their neighbors. And you have seen, you know, sort of neighborhood by neighborhood, people feel like Watertown strong and you know, Southeast strong and that kind of thing. And that's what I've seen in the wake of the bombing.
And, you know, you think of Boston superficially as like, you know, people who are very independent, who don't, you know, who like lip off to authority, that sort of thing. But these deeper connections, neighborhood to neighborhood, is really what rules. You know, the idea that Boston, with a reputation for bad driving, there were no cars on the street.
Right.
During that lockdown.
It was amazing. I mean, it was, you know, it was like a movie set. I mean, it was amazing. It was a situation where you looked at major highways that are usually so clogged with traffic. And Rich knows this. There was nobody there.
Amazing. Well, thanks again to Rich Sorino, former deputy administrator at the Federal Emergency Management Agency, and Kara Miller, host of Innovation Hub here at WGBH. Thanks so much.
Thanks.
Thank you.
The 118th Boston Marathon will take place a week from today with thousands of runners from all over the country and globe. And as we've said, the city and its residents have shown resilience. The motto, Boston Strong, this year. We want to hear from you. Give us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Bounce back story. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry, broadcasting from our partners at WGBH Boston Public Radio. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Reputation.com. With tools to help businesses and professionals manage online reviews and control search results. Introducing reputation scoring for businesses. More at 1-800-REPUTATION or at Reputation.com. TiVo, maker of the TiVo Romeo. Bringing cable TV and streaming apps together in one unified and searchable experience. Available at TiVo.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.